your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a breaking story this afternoon. James O'Keefe and Veritas. Project Veritas. He was speaking at the FRCAction.org seminar in Washington, D.C. just this afternoon, October 12th, 2019. And he added some information about having sent in hidden camera crews into the CNN and interviewed staff and so forth. And he's going to be publishing that soon on his Project Veritas site. But here's a little clip of what he had to say at that symposium when he announced it to the crowd.
We have one announcement to make real quick. Because of what Eric did, another person came to us on the inside. He came to us. We're proud to announce the next insider who will blow the whistle. He's been recording for months. All of his colleagues, his bosses, his senior people. This may be the biggest story Project Veritas has ever broke. Next week, the next insider who will blow the whistle on the next organization is within CNN.
Next coming up is the comment on MSNBC of former ambassador to the Ukraine, Yovanovitch, and They're quoting what she said inside there. No Republicans allowed to quote what went on in behind closed doors. And that's the problem with what's going on in this impeachment inquiry, is that the Republicans can't ask questions. They can't reveal to the public what went on. And they can only discuss this in broad terms. And then Adam Schiff's people come out and they make any kind of comments they want to, or release what they want to selectively, see. And so this is a report by MSNBC on what she actually quoted. They quoted her saying after she came out of the interview with Adam Schiff's Judiciary Committee. So here we go with this report by MSNBC. And we're going to follow that with a report given on Lou Dobbs' program by John Solomon, and he has facts and documents and so forth that refute exactly what this NBC report came out with, quoting former Ambassador Yovanovitch, and it really puts him in a bad position because there's possibly perjury there that was committed by Yovanovitch, according to the facts and figures and so forth that John Solomon has come with over the last year. So here we go with this MSNBC, and I'd have to call it like almost propaganda in a way.
We begin with this story, another diplomat breaking their silence. The ambassador in the growing Ukraine scandal detailing today an unflinching indictment of President Trump and a devastating portrayal of what she described as Donald Trump's very provable diplomatic and national security failings. This being detailed from someone inside the administration, firsthand knowledge. Marie Yovanovitch is the former ambassador to Ukraine, and you saw her there today, walking in to give a deposition to these House impeachment investigators for what turned out to be a very detailed, over 9-hour session, a deposition the Trump administration tried and failed to block. And here, simply put, is how Democratic Congressman Denny Hecht described what he heard from her right after walking out of that deposition today.
I just sat through 8 hours that went like a New York second. It was that amazing, that powerful, that impactful, and I just feel very fortunate to have been there.
fortunate to bear witness to that. Now, we don't have all 8 hours of transcripts in the newsroom, but we do have her opening statement, which says she was incredulous. The U.S. government, that's the Trump administration, chose to remove an ambassador based, as best she could tell, on, quote, unfounded and false claims by people with clearly questionable motives. That is a reference to the man who, as of 10 minutes ago, the New York Times says is under investigation by the New York feds, Rudy Giuliani, and his allies who were trying to make money profiting off U.S. foreign policy. Back to the ambassador, she says in this written statement, individuals who've been named as contacts of Giuliani may well have believed that their personal financial ambitions were stymied by our anti-corruption policy in Ukraine. Yovanovitch said that she was forced to leave Kiev on the very next plane when she got these orders this spring. And the State Department's number two told her, although she had done nothing wrong, this is her account, the president had simply lost confidence in her. Quote, he added that there had been a concerted campaign against me, and the department had been under pressure from the president to remove me since the summer of 2018. Yovanovitch was name-checked by the president on the now infamous phone call with the president of Ukraine, which is the heart of the impeachment matter. The president had said then that it was, quote, bad news, and the people that she was dealing with in Ukraine were also bad news, quote, so I just wanted to let you know that. Now think about this very simply. Trump was expressing that view in what he thought in that moment was a private, secret call that would remain secret, like most of those high-level foreign calls. He couldn't have known that it would soon leak, or that it would tip off the impeachment probe to a new height, or that she would know what he said and strike back today, speaking to this Congress and these investigators considering the impeachment of Donald Trump. But that is what happened. That's what she did today. And she said, quote, our efforts were intended and evidently succeeded in thwarting corrupt interests in Ukraine who fought back by selling baseless conspiracy theories to anyone who would listen. Sadly, someone was listening, and our nation is the worse off for that. I'm just going to pause to tell you, when public servants speak like that in a public forum, they are taking a risk. They're writing off their most recent boss and recommendation and everything else from the Trump administration. But like other whistleblowers and other officials, there is clearly something they're trying to tell us tonight. Now, late this afternoon, we also learned that Ms. Yovanovitch had to be subpoenaed in order to even get that stark assessment out to the public. She's balancing between the orders she gets from the government and then another part of the government, the administration and the Congress. So the House chairs here on the Democratic side said the State Department, at the direction of the Trump White House, directed her not to appear, and thus the House Intelligence Committee issued a subpoena to compel her testimony this morning. Now, next week, these committees have a string of high-profile officials scheduled to give depositions. That includes the Trump Russia advisor, Fiona Hill, NBC reporting she plans to tell Congress Giuliani and EU Ambassador Sondland circumvented the National Security Council and White House process to pursue a, quote, shadow policy on Ukraine. A familiar source tells NBC, and that EU Ambassador, Mr. Sondland, the one who spoke to Trump after being told by a diplomat that their whole plot was, quote, crazy, and that withholding security assistance from Ukraine to go after the Bidens was, quote, crazy. Well, he also plans to testify next week in defiance of those initial Trump efforts to silence him. That's a lot coming down the pike. And there's more. Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, writing to colleagues tonight. I'll put it up on the screen so you see exactly what the news is. He says he will be expecting to announce new testimony from the relevant witnesses in the coming days and prepared to compel testimony through duly authorized subpoenas as appropriate. Here he was right after today's deposition.
I also want to express my appreciation for not just what a great champion she was of the rule of law in Ukraine, but also the respect she has for the rule of law here at home. And her willingness, when served with compulsory process, to follow the law and testify. And I think she is a courageous example for others. I think all the members were extraordinarily impressed with her testimony today.
Let's get right to it. On a breaking news Friday night, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul joins me. He's actually known Ms. Yovanovitch for 30 years. Evelyn Farkas, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Obama administration. Evelyn and Ambassador McFaul are both national security analysts here for us. And also joining us tonight, Joshua Geltzer, a former Senior Director for Counterterror at the National Security Council. He's also the Executive Director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. Ambassador McFaul, what does it mean to hear so starkly from this former ambassador today? And what does it mean to have her point her finger in a measured way, but nonetheless point her finger at Giuliani and his associates when we're learning from the New York Times moments ago that he also is under criminal scrutiny?
Well, first, I just want to underscore what you said earlier, Ari. We've only seen her prepared testimony, right? We have not heard the 9 hours of what she revealed today. In that setting. But the prepared text, I just urge all of your viewers to go and read it. It is profound. It is shocking. She is saying very bluntly that I was trying to do my job as a U.S. official. I took an oath of office to the United States of America, and other private people, and Mr. Giuliani, first and foremost, were trying to interfere into the diplomatic work that she was trying to do. It's just very clear, very blunt, very diplomatic, but I was really shocked at what was in that statement.
Evelyn?
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100% with what Mike just said. I found it not shocking so much because we've gotten so much from the whistleblower and from the transcript of the phone conversation. And there were a lot of whispers about the fact that she, that Ambassador Yovanovitch was essentially pushed out because she was standing up against corruption in Ukraine. What we didn't know, those of us who follow Ukraine, is this other backstory of the fact that there were these rogue Americans who were trying to influence Ukrainian policy and working essentially behind her back or in front of her, but, you know, not paying any heed to her. So making her ineffective and also breaking the law. So, I mean, she's a courageous person. She's a straight arrow. I also worked with her in the administration. And then afterwards, when I was a think tanker and a consultant traveling to Ukraine when she was ambassador, she's a straight arrow. She's very well respected. The good thing about her, I think, is because she's so senior, she really has the strength of the whole Foreign Service behind her. You know, that bureaucracy has a very strong union almost in terms of how they handle personnel issues. So I think that helps in contrast to, for example, Andrew McCabe and the Department of Justice, where he really turned out to have really lost when he came forward and tried to confront his organization.
Mm. I want to play for you what we're hearing from the president, who isn't known to have the deepest grasp of every, you know, public official or every ambassador in the whole country, but has certainly drilled down on Ukraine as a matter of interest and was criticizing this very person. Take a look.
Very bad things about her, and I don't know if I recalled her or somebody recalled her, but I heard very, very bad things about her for a long period of time. Not good.
Evelyn?
Well, again, I mean, we know now from the transcript that he was relaying things that he had heard, and from the whistleblower, that he was relaying basically gossip that he had heard from Giuliani. And I think the other thing that Ambassador Yovanovitch makes very clear in her testimony, if you read it, is that you have to understand what's happening in Ukraine. There are all kinds of factions, and I know Mike McFaul knows this very well, Ambassador McFaul. You know, there are all kinds of factions inside Ukraine. They were using Giuliani as much as he was trying to use them. And she understood who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. And the people who were trying to throw dirt on Joe Biden were not good guys.
Josh?
What President Trump calls bad things, most of us would regard as good things. That's what our former ambassador was doing there, as her testimony today, at least the part of it we've been able to read, makes clear. She was trying to do what any U.S. ambassador should do, which is push a country away from corruption. And the irony is, while Trump has claimed that his dealings with the Ukraine have been his efforts to root out corruption, in fact, it was his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who was injecting corruption into the system.
And Evelyn, when you look at all this together, do you see this as Donald Trump's impeachment stonewall strategy losing out? I mean, we're talking about diplomats and other types who are known for their discretion, who might want to speak and at times disagree with the advice not to speak or the request not to, but they honor it. There's something different happening here when we see what is now a phalanx of officials planning to speak out.
Yes, 100%, Ari, because before, the people that they were preventing from going to testify in the Mueller investigation instance were Don McGahn, a guy who really didn't want to come forward and be a whistleblower and didn't want to testify. So he chose to pretend that this White House ban on him testifying was something real and legal, and he hasn't come forward, right? And some of the other folks that they said that they were going to subpoena, and I don't know, some of these things may be even tied up in the courts, they agreed to pretend that the White House could block them. And what the ambassador did today, what Ambassador Yovanovitch did today, was to prove that that's all a bunch of hot air. If you want to testify, even if you are still working for the U.S. government, you can.
Now, the committee and those on the Democratic left side are trying to pretend that now President Trump has become an instigator and is obstructing people from testifying. He has executive powers, and they just can't take those away, and they're not willing to accept that he still has executive privilege. And the people that are working for him, he can deny them to testify before this committee if he wishes to. Now, Yovanovitch here, this former Yovanovitch, former ambassador to the Ukraine, that is playing up the fact that she has the right to do this no matter what. But listen to what John Solomon has evidence and documents on former Ambassador Yovanovitch and her wrongdoing in the Ukraine. And I think you're going to change your mind a little bit after you listen to this John Solomon interview by Lou Dobbs. Here we go now.
The former U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, on Capitol Hill today for hours. She claimed in those hours she was recalled from her post by President Trump because of unfounded allegations of her partisanship. In her opening statement, Yovanovitch said she understood she served at the pleasure of the president, but as she put it, was incredulous as to why she was removed. Yovanovitch, an Obama holdover, which might be a clue why she would be relieved under any normal situation, reportedly had displayed an outright anti-Trump attitude on a number of occasions while ambassador. Yovanovitch was replaced by former Ukrainian ambassador William Taylor to head the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. Well, joining us tonight, award-winning investigative journalist and Fox Business contributor, I am proud to say. John, great to have you with us. John Solomon.
Thank you, Lou. Good to be here.
First, let's start with Marie Yovanovitch.
Yeah.
Who is, as she says, she accedes to the power of the president to determine who will represent this nation under his leadership. But she is, she is carrying on as if this she had been deeply wrong.
Yeah, we just spent a whole day having a hearing trying to suggest that there might not have been a cause to remove an ambassador who the president needed no cause to remove,
right.
That the president has under the Constitution irrefutable power to remove any civil servant and replace him with who he thinks will better serve. But if you needed a reason, and here's a lot of things. I did a lot of research on Marie Yovanovitch, about 8 months of work before I ever wrote about her. Let's put some things out there that people don't know. In May of 2018, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, pretty powerful guy in Congress, wrote a letter to Mike Pompeo saying he had just gotten back from Ukraine and had heard that the ambassador had made inappropriate comments, negative comments about the president and the administration, and he asked her to recall that ambassador. In November, Ukrainian authorities complained and hired an American lawyer to reach out to the Justice Department saying that the ambassador and her embassy staff were interfering in their investigations. In February, I interviewed the Attorney General of Ukraine, who said that the ambassador had given him a list of names that she did not want to see prosecuted, interfering in the individual prosecution.
Amazing.
Now, before I ever wrote that story, I went to the State Department. You know what the State Department did? They confirmed that they actually gave them a set of names, and the State Department gave me a letter saying, yep, we actually wrote this letter saying don't pursue this George Soros group. So that story's true. But here's one that doesn't get reported a lot, but several career diplomats, former and current, called me in March and said, we just saw Yovanovitch do something extraordinary. It was in the middle of the Ukraine election, and she gave a speech and called for the removal of a prosecutor. The Foreign Affairs Manual makes two clear things. Don't meddle in the internal affairs of your host country, and by sure, don't make statements during an election that could be viewed as political. She gave this speech. It's out and open. People should go look at it and then compare it to what the Foreign Affairs Manual said. If the president needed a reason, he had plenty, but he didn't need any reasons at all. It was his power to remove her for any reason he chose.
And the role of George Soros here, his name keeps coming up in this, in your reporting and the reporting of others. It is peculiar to me. What is his role, or the role of his money, in Ukraine right now?
Well, here's a really interesting thing that people don't focus on, but he had a group called ANTAC, the Anti-Corruption Action Center of Ukraine. It's a, you know, anti-corruption group there. Right. He funds it. Guess who the other funder of it is? The State Department. The State Department is funding one of George Soros's groups. It was that group that Ukraine authorities were investigating for the possible misuse of public funds, that the State Department intervened. Ambassador Yovanovitch's office intervened, the embassy in Kiev, and they wrote a letter saying, please do not prosecute these people. Back off. We don't believe your investigation is warranted. You look at that and you go, in the middle of an election, George Soros, liberal donor, what's our State Department have an interest in that? But let's go even further. Let's look at what happened. A few months later, George Soros's team got a private briefing at the State Department with Marie Yovanovitch's boss, the ambassador for Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and they're talking about a private presentation on Russia bond market issues. What sort of donor gets that level of access that they can meet with the State Department to give their spin on something that affects their business? I think people should look more closely at the public documents, and they'll see a trail between George Soros, the Kiev embassy, and the State Department officials that supervised Marie Yovanovitch. It's sitting out in public.
I'm going to replay that John Solomon interview, but also there's a little bit of Adam Schiff in there also. So I'm going to replay this right now. So in case you missed it the first time around, you'll be able to pick up back on what John Solomon said. But there's also some additional Adam Schiff and some other additional information at the end of this clip. So here we go with Lou Dobbs and John Solomon on the Lou Dobbs Show. Here we go now.
Up next, new details tonight about the connections between Adam Schiff and the so-called, well, CIA plant, I mean whistleblower, and investigative journalist, Fox Business contributor John Solomon joins us right here, right after these quick messages.
The whistleblower reported a totally different conversation than I had. I released a transcript of my conversation, an exact transcript. And the whistleblower didn't say that. The whistleblower is either saying untruths, okay, or he didn't know, or he's making up a story like Schiff did.
The president today blasting the so-called whistleblower or complainant or whatever he may be, perhaps a provocateur. Nonetheless, his comments come as the Washington Examiner reports two aides who worked with the so-called whistleblower, whistleblower one at the White House, they now work for, are you ready for this? Congressman Adam Schiff. The Examiner reporting the two Schiff staffers worked alongside whistleblower one at the National Security Council in the White House. And one of those staffers, Sean Misko, was hired to Schiff's staff in August, the same month, the same very month, the whistleblower's complaint was submitted. Whistleblower one also reportedly worked with Biden, is a registered Democrat, a CIA officer, and someone who apparently doesn't wish to reveal themselves and any more of their second-hand, well, maybe third-hand information. And the former U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, on Capitol Hill today for hours. She claimed in those hours she was recalled from her post by President Trump because of unfounded allegations of her partisanship. In her opening statement, Yovanovitch said she understood she served at the pleasure of the president, but as she put it, was incredulous as to why she was removed. Yovanovitch, an Obama holdover, which might be a clue why she would be relieved under any normal situation, reportedly had displayed an outright anti-Trump attitude on a number of occasions while ambassador. Yovanovitch was replaced by former Ukrainian ambassador William Taylor to head the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. Well, joining us tonight, award-winning investigative journalist and Fox Business contributor, I am proud to say. John, great to have you with us. John Sullivan.
Thank you, Lou. Good to be here.
First, let's start with Marie Yovanovitch.
Yeah.
Who is, as she says, she accedes to the power of the president to determine who will represent this nation under his leadership. But she is, she is carrying on as if this she had been deeply wrong.
Yeah, we just spent a whole day having a hearing trying to suggest that there might not have been a cause to remove an ambassador who the president needed no cause to remove,
right.
That the president has, under the Constitution, irrefutable power to remove any civil servant and replace him with who he thinks will better serve. But if you needed a reason, and here's a lot of things. I did a lot of research on Marie Yovanovitch, about 8 months of work before I ever wrote about her. Let's put some things out there that people don't know. In May of 2018, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, pretty powerful guy in Congress, wrote a letter to Mike Pompeo saying he had just gotten back from Ukraine and had heard that the ambassador had made inappropriate comments, negative comments about the president and the administration, and he asked her to recall that ambassador. In November, Ukrainian authorities complained and hired an American lawyer to reach out to the Justice Department saying that the ambassador and her embassy staff were interfering in their investigations. In February, I interviewed the Attorney General of Ukraine, who said that the ambassador had given him a list of names that she did not want to see prosecuted, interfering in the individual prosecution.
Amazing.
Now, before I ever wrote that story, I went to the State Department. You know what the State Department did? They confirmed that they actually gave them a set of names, and the State Department gave me a letter saying, yep, we actually wrote this letter saying don't pursue this George Soros group. So that story's true. But here's one that doesn't get reported a lot, but several career diplomats, former and current, called me in March and said, we just saw Yovanovitch do something extraordinary. It was in the middle of the Ukraine election, and she gave a speech and called for the removal of a prosecutor. The Foreign Affairs Manual makes two clear things. Don't meddle in the internal affairs of your host country, and by sure, don't make statements during an election that could be viewed as political. She gave this speech. It's out and open. People should go look at it and then compare it to what the Foreign Affairs Manual said. If the president needed a reason, he had plenty, but he didn't need any reasons at all. It was his power to remove her for any reason he chose.
And the role of George Soros here, his name keeps coming up in this, in your reporting and the reporting of others. It is peculiar to me. What is his role, or the role of his money, in Ukraine right now?
Well, here's a really interesting thing that people don't focus on, but he had a group called ANTAC, the Anti-Corruption Action Center of Ukraine. It's a, you know, anti-corruption group there.
Right.
He funds it. Guess who the other funder of it is? The State Department. The State Department is funding one of George Soros' groups. It was that group that Ukraine authorities were investigating for the possible misuse of public funds, that the State Department intervened. Ambassador Yovanovitch's office intervened, the embassy in Kiev, and they wrote a letter saying, please do not prosecute these people, back off, we don't believe your investigation is warranted. You look at that and you go, in the middle of an election, George Soros, liberal donor, what's our State Department have an interest in that? But let's go even further. Let's look at what happened. A few months later, George Soros's team got a private briefing at the State Department with Marie Yovanovitch's boss, the ambassador for Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and they're talking about a private presentation on Russia bond market issues. What sort of donor gets that level of access that they can meet with the State Department to give their spin on something that affects their business? I think people should look more closely at the public documents, and they'll see a trail between George Soros, the Kiev embassy, and the State Department officials that supervised Marie Yovanovitch. It's sitting out in public.
And let me ask you this development. I'm impressed with how swift justice can be implemented when it is apparently a Republican in the focus of the Justice Department. These two Russians who are accused of meddling and improperly violating federal election laws with money for U.S. candidates. And their relationship to Rudy Giuliani, this is so peculiar that immediately, it seems, they are indicted by the Southern District. They're stopped. They've got $1 million bonds on them by the judge.
Yeah.
It's quite a different story than in every other instance that I can think of recently in the last, say, 3 years by the by the Justice Department.
Yeah. Listen, Attorney General Barr signed off on this one. I think it's a legitimate case from what I know. Many reporters, myself included, mm-hmm. knew of these men. They were well known to reporters mm-hmm. who covered Ukraine issues. But let's look at something that happened a couple months ago. Just a few months ago, the Justice Department indicted a famous reggae singer who was a major donor to Barack Obama and was a frequent guest at the Obama White House for doing the same thing, taking foreign money and laundering it into the election. I think it's a priority of the Justice Department to do this. I think the timing of the case just looks to be a coincidence. I don't think it's tied to anything related to impeachment. I think the Attorney General signed off on it. Mm-hmm. Let's see where the facts are, and let's see if these men are guilty or innocent. That's what a jury's for.
It's what a jury's for, and John Solomon always reminding us what great journalists do, and we appreciate it, John.
Thank you, sir.
John Solomon, appreciate it.
Coming up next is Steve Bannon from Greece. He was interviewed about this up and coming. Well, they've announced been announcements out of the White House. There have been some agreements with the Chinese, and I think some of that has to do with farm purchases and so forth by the Chinese. So we're going to play this clip with Steve Bannon. He lays out stuff real well, and then we're going to follow that by more detail by Cavuto, laying out some of the exact more details of the agreement with the Chinese. Here we go now with Steve Bannon.
Now, joining us from Athens today, Greece, is the Squawk Newsmaker of the Hour. You bring us some great shots, Steve. That's a beauty. That looks very familiar up there. That structure looks a little run down. Looks like they've neglected some infrastructure over there as well in Greece, I think. But welcome this morning. That's a great shot. Of the Parthenon and the
that's
Acropolis.
That's the home of democracy, the Acropolis and the Parthenon. So I'm here. Just finished debating Bernard-Henri Levy on globalism versus nationalism here in Athens.
Who won?
You'll have to ask the New York Times. They sponsored it. I'll let the judges call it.
Yeah,
I feel pretty good, though.
Yeah, we'll get a fair answer there. No, we would. So... I don't know what you think about the latest developments. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin was smiling, no teeth, but smiling yesterday. Everybody seemed to be getting along pretty well. We've started calling this, what may come out of this, a skinny deal. Is that what you expect, and is that something that that we should have probably expected all along and not what you would have done? Is it a half measure? Should we have stayed longer at the table to get more out of this?
Well, look, Joe, I think this shows the power of President Trump's program and his negotiating position. I mean, the fact that, you know, you've had early in the week all these announcements about increased agriculture purchases, increased purchases. I think you had something on the CNBC site earlier this morning about potential financial services opening up in China. And you just had, I think, a guest on the previous segment, Mr. Khan, about the strength of American manufacturing, American economy. So, you know, President Trump... his policies and his negotiating position have worked. Remember, the key here is the state-owned industries and the forced technology transfers, the bigger overall deal to restructure their economy. That was this May transaction that Lighthizer and Vice Premier Li He negotiated. You know, China is hurting so much by these tariffs, and what they're trying to do is anything possible to get President Trump, I think, to delay or either nullify the October tariffs. So I wouldn't be surprised today if you saw some interim deal, as I've been talking about. They might do some interim deal. But President Trump's very focused, I think, on the overall deal that starts to bring the supply chain back to the United States. So this will be, I think, inextricably linked to something bigger and more powerful. But, you know, he's up against the cheerleading section of Wall Street and the Chinese that have been, you know, for the last 3 weeks signaling this. But I believe this shows the strength of his negotiating position. And so if we see something today, it's on the smaller side. I think it's leading overall to a larger transaction. Clearly, you know, the hawks and the super hawks want to see the entire deal and want to see that supply chain coming back. And I think you saw President Trump last night in Minnesota. His focus is to bring high value added manufacturing jobs back to the United States.
Steve, though, speak to this. There's a concern that if you take a small deal now, it actually will give the Chinese leverage, that it actually won't give the president, President Trump, that is, more leverage to actually get to the bigger deal.
Yeah, I think that if you see particularly the way that he deals with these tariffs in October, I think you'll see where is the negotiating leverage is. Remember, Trump's a master of knowing how to use negotiating leverage. So I think that this deal will clearly have springs to it or sets to it. If there is a deal, that will lead us to go back. If there's any recalcitrance or any slow walking, remember the two key things are the subsidies to state-owned industries and the forced technology transfers. That's the beating heart of this kind of reorganization of the Chinese economy, this integration into the world economy, and what will start to lead supply chains back to the industrial democracies, including the United States. It's one of the reasons USMCA, which, you know, really needs to get passed, is so important. It's part of this whole overall trade package that President Trump's been working on. So remember, the devil's going to be in the details here. But this, once again, I think shows you it's the Chinese that are coming and offering all types of opportunities, all types of give-ups, to get the tariffs off them. He was right from the beginning. The tariffs have forced them to the negotiating table. This is what the Wall Street cheerleading section has forgotten. It's the tariffs that have forced the Chinese to the table. So I think you'll see in the details where, if there is something announced today, where President Trump will leave himself plenty of room to go back, if there's any backsliding or any lack of focus on trying to get the overall Lighthizer deal eventually right. done.
Hey, Steve, I think you're going to agree with this op-ed. This was an op-ed in the New York Times just yesterday. We were talking about it's a quote that I think almost you could have written. He says, a darker truth is now dawning on the world. China's economic miracle hasn't just failed to liberate Chinese people. And this is the part I'm curious whether you'll agree with. It is now also routinely corrupting the rest of us outside of China. This column referring, I think, to freedom of speech issues related to the NBA. What's your take on that?
You know, we've talked about this many times on the show over the last 6 months. This is the whole, what President Trump's been laying out, and what really, quite frankly, what the Hawks and groups like the Committee on the Present Danger have been talking about. The CCP and the kind of globalists and the party of Davos have infected the entire global system, and really you've seen that this week in the NBA fiasco. What was really shocking is ESPN last night put up the map of China and included the seven dots. It included this highly controversial area in the South China Sea that the Chinese just take for their own sovereignty, away from the nations of the world and away from international law. It's stunning to me how they've corrupted corporate America and really corporations around the world. But this is what people have been saying, and I think now you're seeing it. So whoever wrote that, yes, I 100% agree with it. Quite frankly, wish I'd written it myself.
Steve, what's the alternative? I mean, you look at so many multinational companies, U.S. companies that do a lot of business there but also have supply chains there, and Apple obviously comes top of mind. They've done things like when they report their sales, they report sales for Greater China, which includes Hong Kong and Taiwan, which is the way the Chinese like to have these things done. They've taken apps off of different situations. But these are companies that say they are operating under the laws of the nations that they are serving, and that they while they are trying to promote democracy and their way of thinking, freedom of speech, that they can't exactly do things that that country considers to be illegal. Is the alternative that you can only operate in your own country?
No, the thing is, there are certain rules that you ought to make that you ought to be able as a company to abide by. In China, which is really, you know, with the Uyghur situation, with the organ harvesting, the suppression of the Chinese people. Remember, the Chinese workforce is basically a slave labor workforce. That's what the people in the Hawks on the right and President Trump's have been saying, that the slave labor force is really making goods for the unemployed and underemployed in the industrial democracies. That's the tragedy of what this Frankenstein monster that the City of London, Wall Street, and the giant corporations have allowed to be built. You have to stand for something more than the bottom line. Remember, in the great period of American capitalism, our company stood for something more than just the bottom line. They stood for basic American values and basic values of the West. Look, I'm here in the home of democracy, right? You know, a mile from the Parthenon. You know, we were bequeathed this. And companies like Apple and these companies have to stand up. And this is not just some marginal thing. Yes, every country is going to have certain things that you have to abide by in their business code. But these are fundamental about human rights. Look at the streets of Hong Kong. We've talked about this, guys, now since June 9th. Look at that's the fight for capitalism. That's English common law and Chinese tenacity has built Hong Kong.
But then,
and
Steve,
look at what's happening in those streets. Look at the kids who are fighting.
What do you say to every American company doing business in Saudi Arabia or any other country?
Or Russia.
Or Russia.
China.
Or, I mean, you could go down the list. What's the answer then?
Look, I don't think you see, there's clearly not in Saudi Arabia or Russia what you see in China. Okay, you don't see what they're doing to the Uyghurs. You don't see what they're doing to the Tibetan Buddhists and the Dalai Lama. You don't see what they're doing to the house Christians and the underground Catholic Church. You don't see the human harvesting of organs. The Chinese Communist Party, this is not the Chinese people. The Chinese Communist Party are suppressed by these people. Clearly, the monarchies in the Gulf and Russia have certain problems, and I think America is trying to address those problems. They're trying to address those problems clearly with our allies in the Middle East. And certainly you're seeing a liberalization starting there. In Russia, we've got to confront what the kleptocracy is doing there. But you can't compare any of those to what the Chinese Communist Party is doing. And finally, people are stepping up to it. Corporate America is getting smash meth now by the CCP for what are just small outside their lanes. And you see that these people are dropping the hammer on them. I think this is a lesson for every American, exactly how the Chinese Communist Party treats their own people.
Hey, Steve, I don't want to take anything away from what they're doing to the Uyghurs. That's 1.5 million people that they've put in re-education camps, and they're holding back. Nothing from that at all. But if you look at places like Saudi Arabia, women for a long time have not had any sort of freedoms. And you're right, things are opening up in different places. But, again, I just want to say it's really tricky to try and operate.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you. Look, the women, and you've seen with MBS, you know, with all his faults, you're starting to see they're getting driver's license, and nobody supports the suppression. And nobody supports the suppression of really the Christians in Saudi Arabia. But you can't compare that to the Uyghurs. These are not re-education camps. These are concentration camps. Okay? And we finally put sanctions on the companies that are doing it. You've seen what they've done with the organ harvesting. You've seen what they've done to the Tibetan Buddhists and the Dalai Lama, the underground Christian church and their own people. You cannot compare the Gulf Emirates. You can't compare Russia with all of their faults. You can't compare those with what the Chinese Communist Party has done to its own people. And you see that in the streets of Hong Kong every day.
Yeah, that was Steve Bannon. We're going to be bringing up next this Cavuto interview. He lays out, like I said earlier, some of the details of the Chinese and American trade agreement with the proviso agreement that Trump will hold off on these October tariffs that he was planning on putting on. And they think that they're getting closer and closer to an overall trade agreement, but that remains to be seen. But here's Cavuto. And also at the end of this, he interviews Andy McCarthy. And Andy lays out some of the, you could say what the going-ons of the impeachment proceedings. And then I'm going to follow that by even a more detailed rights of the House to hold these impeachment inquiries. But anyway, here we go with Cavuto.
Clarity's sake, you've heard it called a partial deal, a skinny deal, a placeholder. But by any measure, there's certainly some celebration among farmers and those investors on the corner of Wall and Broad. Any progress is going to be celebrated right now, in particular, given what we've been through over the last 15 months. Let me tell you about the deal that the president was referencing last night in those comments over in Louisiana. I had a great time, by the way. It's not the deal of all deals, but it does, Neil, touch on a number of sectors, with new provisions set to impact agriculture, banking, technology, energy, and currency sectors, also some intellectual property protections as well. Now, here's the bottom line. The U.S. agrees, Neil, not to proceed with a hike in tariffs to 30% from 25% on about $250 billion in Chinese goods. China, therefore, agrees to make purchases of between $40 and $50 billion in U.S. ag goods, which really takes the edge off, Neil, for those hit by China's targeted actions meant to hit the president's base in the Midwest. So for them, this is obviously great news. However, no great news to report for Huawei, the Chinese telecom giant. Not part of this agreement. As you know, the company was put on an export blacklist back in
highest point thus far. So they were purchasing 16 or 17 billion at the highest point, and that'll be brought up to 40 billion to 50 billion. So I'd suggest the farmers have to go and immediately buy more land and get bigger tractors. They'll be available at John Deere and a lot of other great distributors.
Pretty good line there. If you're a John Deere backer, you're certainly happy to hear the president talk about that. So negotiators, Neil, have several weeks to try to hammer out the details. In the meantime, taking the edge off just a bit by holding off on those tariffs, Neil.
Do you know, Kevin, how we can keep track of China, whether it's doing all this stuff it's supposed to do?
That's a great question. Part of the problem is whenever you talk about are the Chinese actually following through, is you can sort of track month to month. We've seen an increase in the purchase of American agricultural goods over the past month was great numbers, but again, fairly often, I think you and I have talked about this, they'll say one thing and maybe not follow through all the way, but obviously that's something that Steve Mnuchin and the rest of the White House team will be tracking very, very carefully, Neil.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. Of course, referring to the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin. So how significant is this deal to our market pros? Heather Herzog, Dan Geltrude with us, Deirdre Bolton. Deirdre, what do you think? The market liked it. It was off its highs by the end of Friday, but it was still up more than 300. What do you think?
Well, I just want to highlight the difference in vocabulary. So we're calling it a phase one deal. And I spoke to some of my friends who speak Mandarin, and they said in the Chinese press that the word that they are using is pause, as in pause in the trade war. So I'm paying attention to that.
Troops comes up.
Exactly.
Troops, right.
Just this kind of, okay, it's a circuit breaker, but there's so much more to be done. And a lot of the things that we were looking to do that the Trump administration has been looking to do for a long time, there's still not a lot of clarity. I mean, so they've basically said we've reached some understanding, right, on IP, on financial services, the ag deal. But that ag deal, that surge in Chinese purchases of U.S. products, I mean, that was basically what was on the table 2 years ago. So it feels like we've kind of come back full circle. So I don't know if that's a win. What I consider a win is the tone. I was in D.C. yesterday, and when we had the U.S. trade rep Lighthizer walking in, Steve Mnuchin walking in, there were smiles. It was sunny. People were waving. Even the Chinese Vice Premier, Liu He, he was smiling. He was shaking hands with some journalists. So tone-wise, I think this is a win. As for the details, I mean, even phase one, it's very clear it's going to take 3 to 5 weeks to just write down what was discussed. And, I mean, listen, we've all seen a lot of these parts move in much less time than 3 to 5 weeks.
Yeah, you know, Dan, another thing, and you've reminded me that sometimes a partial trade deal is better than no trade deal, even one where we don't have the I's dotted, T's crossed. And that'll come out to Duda's point in the next few weeks, I assume. But it beats the alternative, right?
It certainly does. But what we need to keep in mind here, Neil, this is a fragile situation, right? Because we saw what the Chinese did back in May. We thought we had a deal, and they stepped away. So there's a lot of uncertainty here, and I think the market actually reacted to that as the day went on. Initially, there was euphoria. Hey, we got a deal. As more details came out, we realized, wait a minute, is this actually playing more to the Chinese hand in that they would like to do this over time, step by step, multiple phases? Remember, the president not so long ago said, if we can't get one big deal, there'll be no deal. Now, the president has backed off of that. I think the market is getting a little concerned. Good news. I agree with you, Deirdre. It's a good tone. Yeah. But this process is going to take a long time, and that is what the Chinese want it to be.
You know, Heath, I'm wondering, too, consumers probably don't much care about the details here, just as long as mean those tariffs don't go into effect, the prospect of potentially much higher prices at Christmas time go into effect. There's little likelihood of that anyway. But I'm wondering, then, does this clear the field for what could be a very strong holiday shopping season, which is already strong.
Right, it's already strong. The tipping point for the tariffs is when prices go up by 10%. As far as we're concerned right now, the only product that has really increased are bicycles. So unless people are out there and that's the only thing that they're going to buy for the holiday, that's where people are really going to be concerned. In fact, we looked at
just don't exercise.
Exactly. Don't get on that Peloton. I think they were talking about mobile bikes as opposed to stationary.
They're clear.
Right. Those are clear. Those are clear. Bed Bath & Beyond just appointed a new CEO, and the chief financial officer during the earnings report was talking about how the tariffs did not really have an impact on the way that their shopper was shopping, and it's not really having an impact on sales at all. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of chief financial officers on earnings calls say that as we get through the next quarter.
As an excuse?
And to your point, it's not an excuse. It's just the truth. I mean, the consumer is not, as far as we're concerned right now, they're not feeling any sort of blowback on potential price increases.
One of the signs of goodwill, right, that we did yesterday was on Tuesday, another 5% was supposed to be layered on the $250 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods, and it was supposed to go from 25%, where we stand now, to 30%. And so the U.S. government, the Trump administration, did say, okay, we're not going to do that 5% increase. The December tariffs is still on the table, of course, and then the next big meeting, I think, right, is in the middle of November, Santiago, Chile, right? Like, that is supposed to be where President Xi Jinping may meet with President Trump. And I'm assuming that we want some details worked out before then.
I always wonder, and Heather touched on it, Dan, the CEOs, the purchasing managers, the CFOs, the chief financial officers, who've been saying this uncertainty was weighing into their expansion plans, hiring plans, more cap spending. If you remove that, or the potential of removing that, doesn't that sort of uncoil all this sort of pent-up activity that's supposed to be out there?
I don't think that we're really going to get to the point, Neil, where we're going to get rid of uncertainty.
Yeah.
I just think...
We'll just find something else to worry about, right?
It's going to take a long time to have some good news.
Who cares what the impetus is? You know,
I think it's clear as day. And to your point, it's baked into the numbers. You know, I think we used to see the markets. I mean, the markets do react to this whiplash, but when it comes to the consumer, it's baked into the numbers. They are not even responding to the whiplash anymore. This uncertainty is part of the...
Well, it is uncanny, isn't it? I mean, you can chart... The president, I think, even said this yesterday. You can chart the market's direction based on optimism or the lack thereof on trade, right?
Yeah.
So if the market ended the day still up 300 points, again, a couple of hundred from where its highs were earlier, maybe that owes to the concern about impeachment. They don't want to lose this guy.
I was just going to say, and tying together all of this, of course, is President Trump's tweets. Do you remember him tweeting out something like, if this happens, like, why would you essentially remove the guy? If you remove me, the markets will crash. I mean, I'm paraphrasing very heavily here, but he has also...
I remember that was Bill Clinton's message without saying it.
You know, look
at the wind that on my back here, the markets, the economy,
right.
the job.
That was an era of, I guess, subtlety and language.
Right.
I think that's exactly what President Trump is doing. He's looking at the Bill Clinton playbook and saying no one is going to want to impeach a president with a strong economy. And that's the bottom line.
He's argued that it was one thing that hurt Richard Nixon. He might have been impeached or had to resign regardless.
Right.
But it didn't help that we had stagflation, an oil crisis, an economy that was turning south during that exact time. This president is blessed with, a very strong market, very strong economy, record low unemployment. I've always said that Wall Street isn't red or blue. They're green. They love money, and they've been making it hand over fist. They don't want that to go.
I think when it comes to impeachment or any sort of reelection, if the economy has any sort of faltering, that is what's going to have an impact on the president. Now, from what I can see, all of these steps are just to protect the fact that the economy is surging ahead. So this is a political play here.
Do you think that, the president needed it more than the Chinese, vice versa? What do you think?
I think the Chinese definitely need this trade deal, but at this point, I think the president probably needs things to be extremely copacetic as we go into the next, we're in an election cycle here, and so if there
is positivity.
If there's any sort of waves, then,
But it is, to your point, they're only phase one. There are going to be other phases, but it is a start. But we know that this is a tempestuous relationship. Just look what happened this week with Blizzard, the big game makers, and going after then easing up on that one kid who had dared
and lots
criticize.
Of things change, right?
Right.
As Dan said, at one
drama.
Point it was
Hong
supposed
Kong.
To be a big deal or no deal, and now we have a little deal in three parts. Also, do you remember there was supposed to be an enforcement mechanism at some point put in so that we could really, if the Chinese were reneging, if we perceived that they were reneging on any of their commitments, that there would be something, some sort of accountability. And that did not come up anywhere yesterday.
Yeah, Chuck Schumer did praise the fact that there were no concessions made to Huawei. So that's an interesting development. The president certainly didn't cave on these issues, but they are looking at it for phase two, phase three, whatever, right?
I think what's happening here, which plays into the president having some leverage, as the Chinese look at this situation, this is a bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
Basically, everybody knows China has been a bad actor related to trade, and everybody wants to bring them to a point of trust but verify where we can get a good deal. But there's no question in my mind, Neil, that some of the leverage related to impeachment has shifted to the Chinese because the president really needs to get something done. He can't afford to have the economy falter with the election coming up.
All right. Speak of the president on that very issue, tweeting just a few moments ago, the deal that I just made with China is by far the greatest and biggest deal ever made for our great patriot farmers in the history of our country. In fact, there is a question as to whether or not this much product can be produced. Our farmers will figure it out. Thank you, China. He goes on to say other aspects of the deal are also great. Technology, financial services, 16 to 20 billion in Boeing planes, et cetera. But wow, the farmers really hit pay dirt. I'm not sure they really hit pay dirt. I'm just looking at the overall agricultural benefits they're going to get from China. We're talking certainly the strongest since the trade war went into effect, but there is considerable debate because we don't know the time horizon of those purchases, whether they're stronger than where we stood before any of this hit the fan. We'll have more after this. Bush, it's going nonstop. The White House continues demanding a full House vote in that impeachment, Bush, or they don't cooperate. And big questions as to whether they even get that inquiry vote. They will cooperate. The former assistant U.S. attorney, Andrew McCarthy, with us right now. Andrew, what do you think of that? Explain to me if you get, and I know you patiently have done this in the past, but the significance of such a vote that would compel cooperation from the White House. How does that work?
Well, the subpoena power, and the impeachment power, Neil, in the Constitution is committed to the House of Representatives, to the institution, not to individual members of the House, not even to the Speaker of the House, who may be first among equals, but she's just 1/435th of the House. So the House acts by voting. That's how it acts as an institution. And if it's going to do something as important as impeach the President of the United States with an eye toward removing him, that ought to be done by the institution that the Constitution puts in charge of impeachment, not by one member or a cabal of partisan committee chiefs.
So you get that it would clear the hurdle to coordinate all of these various committees' work on trying to impeach the president, right? So how would that work?
Well, Neil, we always have to remember that impeachment's political. It's not legal. And there's, you know, two sides of the coin for the White House. On the one hand, yes, the House should work as an institution. On the other hand, because impeachment is fully committed to the House, there's no court that can tell them what they have to do or how they have to do it. So I think that, you know, the president is taking really a political position that if they don't vote as an institution, he as the chief executive need not cooperate. We'll have to see how that all plays out. Whether the court would get involved in that is dubious. And what exactly the House needs to give the president in the way of due process protections as they go forward also is up for negotiation. The House has an incentive, if they really want to do this in a serious way, to make it not only look but be legitimate. So the president should get a right to confront witnesses. The minority should get at least some subpoena power. But you know, this all has to be negotiated. The House doesn't have to give them anything, and I don't think any court can make them.
Well, that pretty well does it for this evening. Just reiterating a little bit, summarizing this hour, we had an announcement by James O'Keefe that he went in and had surveilled or with hidden cameras the CNN personnel and staff, and he's got some really doozies coming out of there. We've got this Yovanovitch that possibly has committed perjury in this House testimony. We don't know for sure. We don't even know if she was sworn in. You know, it's the way it goes there on this particular committee. They can't really talk about it. The Republicans are prohibited from even speaking out publicly about it. But anyway, and so forth. And things are just unwinding, and they're not offering Trump administration due process at this time, and this is not good, and he just continues to fight this thing. But we want to thank everyone for listening this evening, and we're just going to continue to bring a few of these bits and pieces of truth to you the best way we know how. And this John Solomon, he's one of the finest writers. He writes for The Hill. I think he's a vice president of that broadcast network and publication. But anyway, he's a fine person. He's well respected. Lou Dobbs and all these people that we're putting out here, Cavuto and so forth, are well thought of. Thank you for listening tonight. God bless everyone.